The place in Terre Haute let him go when he was 13. They didn't know if he was cured or not, but they said he was. They needed his room so they could put some other crazy kid in it for a couple of years. Trash Can went home. He was way behind in his schoolwork now, and he couldn't seem to catch the hang of it. They had given him shock treatments in Terre Haute, and when he got back to Poutonville, he couldn't remember things. He would study for a test and then forget half the stuff and flunk with a 60 or a 40 or something like that. For a while, he didn't light any fires. Everything was the way it should be again, it seemed. The father-killing sheriff was gone. He was up there in Gary putting headlights on Dodges, putting wheels on miscarriages, his mother sometimes said. His mother was back working in the Poutonville Cafe. It was all right. Of course, there was cheery oil, the white tanks rising on the horizon like oversized whitewashed tin cans, and behind them the industrial smokes from Gary, where the father-killing sheriff was, as if Gary was already on fire. He often wondered how the cheery oil tanks would go up. 3 single explosions, loud enough to rip your eardrums to tatters and bright enough to fry your eyeballs in their sockets. 3 pillars of fire, father, son, and holy father-killing sheriff, that would burn day and night for months, or would they maybe not burn at all? Now he would find out. The soft summer breeze puffed out the first 2 matches he lit, and he dropped their blackened stumps onto the riveted steel. Off to his right, near the knee-high railing that circled the edge of the tank, he saw a bug struggling weakly in a puddle of gasoline. "I'm like that bug," he thought resentfully. "And what kind of a world was it where God would leave you stuck in a big sticky mess like a bug in a puddle of gas?" It was a world that deserved to burn, that was what. He stood, head bowed, a 3rd match ready to strike when the breeze died. For a while, when he came back, he was called loony and halfwit and torchy. But Carly Yates, who was by then 3 grades ahead, remembered the trash cans, and it was Carly's name that stuck. When he turned 16, he left school with his mother's permission. "What do you expect? They ruined him down there in Terre Haute. I'd sue him if I had the money. Shock treatments, they call it. Goddamned electric chair, I call it." And went to work at the scrub-a-dubba car wash. Soaped the headlights, soaped the rocker panels, knocked the wipers, swiped the mirrors. "Hey, mister, you want hot wax with that?" And for a little while longer, things went their appointed course. People would yell at him from street corners or passing cars, would want to know what old Lady Semple, now 4 years in her grave, had said when he lit up her pension check, or if he had wet the bed after he torched that house over in Sedley. And they'd catcall to each other as they lounged in front of the candy store or leaned in the doorway of O'Toole's. They'd holler to each other to hide their matches or butt their smokes because the trash can man was on his way. The voices all became phantom voices, but the rocks were impossible to ignore when they came whizzing from the mouths of dark alleys or from the other side of the street. Once someone had pegged a half-full can of beer at him from a passing car, and the beer can had struck him on the forehead and had driven him to his knees. That was life. The voices, the occasional flying rock, the scrub-a-dubba. And on his lunch break, he would sit where he had been sitting today, eating the BLT his mother had made for him, looking at the cheery oil tanks and wondering which way it would be. That was life, until one night he found himself in the vestibule of the Methodist church with a 5-gallon can of gasoline, splashing it everywhere, especially on the heaps of old hymnals in the corner, and he had stopped and thought, "This is bad. They'll know who did it. They'll know who did it even if someone else did it, and they'll put you away." He thought about it and smelled gas while the voices fluttered and circled in his head like bats in a haunted belfry. Then a slow smile came to his face, and he had upended the gas can and he had run straight up the center aisle with it, the gas spraying out, all the way from the vestibule to the altar he had run, like a groom late to his own wedding, and so eager that he had begun to spray hot fluid more properly meant for his soon-to-be marriage bed. Then he had run back to the vestibule, had pulled a single wooden match from his breast pocket, had scratched it on the zipper of his jeans, had flung the match at the pile of dripping hymnals, direct hit, ka-flump. And the next day he was riding to the Northern Indiana Correctional Center for Boys, past the black and smoldering ribs of the Methodist church. And there was Carly Yates leaning against the light standard across from the scrub-a-dubba, a lucky strike pasted in the corner of his mouth, and Carly yelled, "Hey, trash can, why'd you want to burn up a church? Why didn't you burn up the school?" He was 17 when he went to the jail for kids, and when he turned 18, they sent him over to the state prison. And how long was he there? Who knew? Not the trash can man, that was for sure. No one cared that he had burned the Methodist church down. Not in state prison, they didn't. There were people there who had done worse. Murder, rape, breaking open the heads of old lady librarians. Some of the inmates wanted to do something to him, and some of them wanted him to do something to them. He didn't mind. It happened after the lights were out. One man with a bald head had said he loved him. "I love you, Donald." And that was sure better than dodging rocks. Sometimes he would think, "Just as long as I can stay in here forever." But sometimes at night he would dream of cheery oil, and in the dreams it was always a single thundering explosion, followed by two others. And the sound was wham, wham, wham. Huge, toneless explosions, slamming their way into bright daylight, shaping the daylight like the blows of a hammer shape thin copper. And everyone in town would stop what they were doing and look north, toward Gary, toward where the three tanks stood against the sky, like oversized, whitewashed tin cans. Carly Yates would be trying to sell a 2-year-old Plymouth Fury to a young couple with a baby, and he would stop in mid-spiel and look. The idlers in O'Toole's and in the candy store would crowd outside, leaving their beers and chocolate malteds behind. In the cafe, his mother would pause in front of the cash register. The new boy at the scrub-a-dubba would straighten from the headlights he had been soaping, the sponge glove still on his hand, looking north as that huge and portentous sound sledgehammered its way into the thin copper routine of the day. Wham! That was his dream. He became a trustee somewhere along the line, and when the strange sickness came, they sent him to the infirmary. And some days ago, there had been no more sick people because all of those who had been sick were now dead. Everybody was dead or had run off, except for a young guard named Jason Debbins, who sat behind the wheel of a prison laundry truck and shot himself. And where else did he have to go then, except home? He struck another match and dropped it. The burning match landed in a small pool of gasoline, and the gas caught. The flames were blue. They spread out delicately, a kind of corona with the burned match stub at its center. Trash Can watched for a moment, paralyzed with fascination, and then he stepped quickly to the stairs that circled around the tank to the bottom, looking back over his shoulder. He could see the pumping machinery through a heat haze now, flickering back and forth like a mirage. The blue flames, no more than 2 inches high, spread toward the machinery and toward the open pipe in a widening semicircle. The bug's struggles had ended. It was nothing but a blackened husk. I could let that happen to me. But he didn't seem to want to. It seemed vaguely that there might be another purpose in his life now, something very grand and great. So he felt a touch of fear, and he began to descend the steps on the run, his shoes clanging, his hand slipped quickly over the steep, rust-pitted railing. Down and down, circling, wondering how long until the vapor hanging around the mouth of the outflow pipe would catch, how long before heat great enough for ignition would rush down the pipe's throat and into the tank's belly. Hair flying back from his forehead, a terrified grin pasted to his face, the wind roaring in his ears, he rushed down. Now he was halfway, racing past the letters CH, letters 20 feet high and lime green against the white of the tank. Down and down, and if his flying feet stuttered or caught on anything, he would tumble like the gas can had tumbled, his bones breaking like dead branches. The ground came closer, the white gravel around the tanks, the green grass beyond the gravel. The cars in the parking lot began to regain their normal size. And still he seemed to be floating, floating in a dream, and he would never reach the bottom, only run and run and get nowhere. He was next to a bomb, and the fuse was lit. From far overhead there came a sudden loud bang, like a 5-inch 4th of July firecracker. There was a dim clang, and then something whirred past him. It was part of the outflow pipe, he saw with a sharp and almost delicious fear. It was totally black and twisted into a new and excitingly senseless shape by the heat. He placed one hand on the railing and vaulted over, hearing something snap in his wrist. Sickening pain flowed up his arm to the elbow. He dropped the last 25 feet, landed on the gravel, and went sprawling. The gravel scraped skin from his forearms, but he hardly felt it. He was full of moaning, grinning panic now, and the daylight seemed very bright. Trash Can Man scrambled up, craning his head around and back, sending his gaze up even as he began to run again. The top of this middle tank had grown yellow hair, and the hair was growing at an amazing rate. The whole thing could blow at any second. He ran, his right hand flopping on its broken wrist. He leaped over the parking lot curb, and his feet slapped on asphalt. Now he was across the parking lot, his shadow trailing at his feet, and now he was running straight down the wide gravel access road and bolting through the half-open gate and back onto Highway 130. He ran straight across it and flung himself into the ditch on the far side, landing on a soft bed of dead leaves and wet moss, his arms wrapped around his head, the breath tearing in and out of his lungs like stabbing jackknives. The oil tank blew. Not wham, but kawhap, a sound so huge, yet at the same time so short and guttural, that he felt his eardrums actually press in and his eyeballs press out as the air somehow changed. A second explosion followed, then a third, and Trash Can writhed on the dead leaves and grinned and screamed soundlessly. He sat up, holding his hands over his ears, and sudden wind struck him and slapped him flat with such power that he might have been no more than a piece of litter. The young saplings behind him bent over backward, and their leaves made a frantic whirring sound, like the pennants over a used car lot on a windy day. One or two snapped with small, flat cracking sounds, as if someone was shooting a target pistol. Burning pieces of the tank started to fall on the other side of the road, some actually on the road. They hit with a clanging noise, the rivets still hanging in some chunks, twisted and black, as the outflow pipe had been. Kawham! Trash Can sat up again and saw a gigantic fire tree beyond the Cheery Oil parking lot. Black smoke was billowing from its top, rising straight to an amazing height before the wind could disrupt it and rafter it away. You couldn't look at it without squinting your eyes almost shut, and now there was radiant heat baking across the road at him, tightening his skin, making it feel shiny. His eyes were gushing water in protest. Another burning chunk of metal, this one better than 7 feet across at its widest, and shaped like a diamond, fell out of the sky, landed in the ditch 20 feet to his left, and the dry leaves on top of the wet moss were instantly ablaze. Kawham! Kawham! If he stayed here, he would go up in a jigging, screaming blaze of spontaneous combustion. He scrambled to his feet and began to run along the shoulder of the highway in the direction of Gary, the breath getting hotter and hotter in his lungs. The air had begun to taste like heavy metal. Presently, he began to feel his hair to see if he had started burning. The sweet stench of gasoline filled the air, seeming to coat him. Hot wind rippled his clothes. He felt like something trying to escape from a microwave oven. The road doubled before his watering eyes, then trebled. There was another coughing roar as rising air pressure caused the Cheery Oil Company office building to implode. Scimitars of glass wickered through the air. Chunks of concrete and cinder block rained out of the sky and hailed on the road. A whizzing piece of steel about the size of a quarter and the thickness of a Mars bar sliced through Trash Can's shirt sleeve and made a thin scrape on his skin. A piece big enough to have turned his head to guava jelly struck in front of his feet and then bounded away, leaving a good-sized crater behind. Then he was beyond the fallout zone, still running, the blood beating in his head as if his very brain had been sprayed with number 2 heating oil and then set ablaze. Kawham! That was another one of the tanks, and the air resistance in front of him seemed to disappear, and a large, warm hand pushed him firmly from behind, a hand that fitted every contour of his body from heels to head. It shoved him forward with his toes barely touching the road, and now his face bore the terrified, pan-sweating grin of someone who has been attached to the world's biggest kite in a high cap of wind, and let loose to fly, fly, baby, up into the sky until the wind goes somewhere else, leaving him to scream all the way down in a helpless power dive. From behind, a perfect fusillade of explosions, God's ammunition dump going up in the flames of righteousness, Satan storming heaven, his artillery captain a fiercely grinning fool with red flayed cheeks, trash can man by name, never to be Donald Merwin Elbert again. Sights jittering by, cars wrecked off the road, Mr. Strang's blue mailbox with the flag up, a dead dog with its legs up, a power line down in a cornfield. The hand was not pushing him quite so hard now. Resistance had come back in front. Trash risked a glance back over his shoulder and saw that the knoll where the oil tanks had stood was a mass of fire. Everything was burning. The road itself seemed to be on fire back there, and he could see the summer trees going up like torches. He ran another quarter mile, then dropped into a puffing, blowing, shambling walk. A mile further on, he rested, looking back, smelling the glad smell of burning. With no fire trucks and firefighters to put it out, it would go whatever way the wind took it. It might burn for months. Powhatanville would go, and the fire line would march south, destroying houses, villages, farms, crops, meadows, forests. It might get as far south as Terre Haute, and it would burn that place he had been in. It might burn further. In fact, his eyes turned north again, toward Gary. He could see the town now, its great stacks standing quiet and blameless, like strokes of chalk on a light blue blackboard. Chicago beyond that. How many oil tanks? How many gas stations? How many trains standing silent on sidings full of LP gas and flammable fertilizer? How many slums as dry as kindling? How many cities beyond Gary and Chicago? There was a whole country ripe for burning under the summer sun. Grinning, Trash Can Man got to his feet and began to walk. His skin was already going lobster red. He didn't feel it, although that night it would keep him awake in a kind of exultation. There were bigger and better fires ahead. His eyes were soft and joyful and utterly crazy. They were the eyes of a man who has discovered the great axle of his destiny and has laid his hands upon it. Chapter 27. The smell was awful. It came in through the open sliding door that gave on the balcony, riding the cool morning breeze that would give way to still, humid heat later on in the day. You could say the smell was like moldy oranges or spoiled fish, or the smell you sometimes got in subway tunnels when the train windows were open. But no metaphor would really cover the flat truth. It was the smell of dead bodies, decomposing dead bodies, thousands of them. No, this was, after all, New York, millions of them. That was the flat truth, no matter how much you might want to gussy it up by making fancy metaphors about moldy oranges or subway tunnels. It was the smell of the rotting dead. The power was still on, but Larry didn't think it would be for much longer. It had gone out in half of Brooklyn and all of Queens already. Last night, standing on the balcony, he and Rita had seen a dark pocket across 110th. And looking the other way toward Jersey, you could see bright lights in Jersey City and maybe Bayonne, but the rest of the Jersey shore was dark. The blackness meant the air conditioning was gone as well as the lights. It meant that all the people who had died quietly in their apartments and tenements were now rotting in furnished ovens. And when he thought of that, his mind returned to the thing he had seen in the Park Comfort Station. He had dreamed about that, and in his dreams that black sweet treat came to life and beckoned him and seemed to be something more than a living dead comic book monster. The black sweet treat seemed to be turning into a living man, or thing, that wanted him. A relentlessly grinning spook who walked the night. These dreams disturbed him deeply. And Rita was troubled by the monster shouter. He and Rita had found him in Central Park yesterday, lying beside one of the paths in a huge pool of his own blood. His glasses, with their one mended bow, lay beside one stiffening hand, both lenses shattered. Some monster had been abroad after all, apparently. Rita had screamed and screamed, and when her hysteria had finally quieted, she insisted that they bury him. And so they had. And going back to the apartment, Rita had begun to change into the woman he was faced with this morning. "It's all right," Larry said. She started away, and he grabbed her firmly by the shoulders and made her sit down. She looked at him from darkly circled eyes. "What you're going to do," he said, "is eat. Scrambled eggs, toast, coffee. Then we're going to get some maps and see what's the best way to get off Manhattan. We'll have to walk, you know."
"Yes, I suppose we will."
He went into the kitchenette, not wanting to watch her have the shakes. He got the last two eggs, cracked them into a bowl, and began to beat them. "Where do you want to go?" he asked.
"What? I don't..."
"Which way?" he said with a touch of impatience. "North? New England's that way. South? I really don't see any point in that. We could..." A strangled sob. He turned and saw her looking at him, her hands warring in her lap, her eyes shiny. "What's the matter?" he asked, going to her. "Rita, what is it?"
"I don't think I can eat," she sobbed. "I know you want me to. I'll try, but the smell..."
He crossed the living room and trundled the glass door shut. "There," he said lightly, hoping the annoyance he felt with her didn't show.
"Better?"
"Yes," she said eagerly.
"That's a lot better. I can eat now."
He went back to the kitchenette and scrambled the eggs, grating a little cheese into them as he went. Debussy filled the apartment, too light and pretty for Larry's taste. He didn't care much for classical music, but if you were going to have it, you ought to have your Beethoven or your Wagner or something like that. She had asked him in a casual manner what he did for a living. The casual manner, he reflected with some resentment, of a person for whom anything so simple as a living had never been a problem. "I was a rock and roll singer," he told her, slightly amazed at how really painless that past tense was. "Sing with this band for a while, then that one, sometimes a studio session." She had nodded, and that was the end of it. He had no urge to tell her about the single. That was the past, too. It had no bearing on where they were now. He put the eggs on a plate, added a cup of instant coffee with a lot of cream and sugar. Larry himself subscribed to the trucker's credo of, "If you wanted a cup of cream and sugar, why'd you ask for coffee?" and brought it to the table. She was sitting on a hassock, holding her elbows and facing the stereo. Debussy strained out of the speakers like melted butter. "Soup's on," he said, and she came to the table with a wan smile, looking at the eggs the way a track and field runner might look at a set of hurdles. Then she sat down and began to eat.
"Good," she said. "You were right, thank you."
"Welcome," he said. "Now look, what I'm going to suggest is this. We go down 5th to 39th and turn west, cross to New Jersey by the Lincoln Tunnel, then follow 495 and..." "Those eggs okay? They're not spoiled, are they?" She smiled.
"They're fine."
She forked more into her mouth and followed it with a sip of coffee.
"Go on."
"We might pick up a couple of Yamahas or something. There'll be a lot of stalled traffic on the roads. I thought we could head northeast, maybe end up in Maine. How does an estate on the ocean sound to you? Maybe in Booth Bay or Camden or Bar Harbor?" He had been looking out the window, thinking as he spoke, and now he turned back to her. What he saw scared him badly. She was smiling, but the expression was more of a grimace. Sweat stood out on her face.
"Rita? Jesus, Rita, what?" "Sorry."
She scrambled up, knocking her chair over, and fled across the living room. One foot hooked the hassock she had been sitting on and rolled it on its side like an oversized checker. "Rita?" Then she was in the bathroom, and through the closed door he could hear the low, wrenching sounds of her breakfast coming up. He slammed his hand flat on the table in irritation, then got up and went in after her. God, he hated it when people puked. It always made you feel like puking yourself. The smell of American cheese in the bathroom made him want to gag. Rita was sitting on the tile floor, legs folded under her, head hanging weakly over the bowl. She wiped her mouth with a swatch of toilet paper and looked up at him pleadingly, her face paper pale.
"I just couldn't eat it, Larry. I'm sorry."
Well, Jesus, Rita, if you knew it was going to make you do that, why did you try? Because you wanted me to, and I didn't want you to be angry with me. But you are. You are angry. His mind went back to the lovemaking of the night before. She had screwed with such febrile energy that he found himself thinking of her age and feeling a little disgusted. She went at it so hard that it was a little like being caught in one of those exercise machines. He had come quickly, almost in self-defense, and a long while later she had fallen back, panting and unfulfilled. Moments later she had drawn close to him, and once again he had been able to smell her sachet, the same sort of scent his mother had worn, and she had murmured the thing that had jerked him back from the edge of sleep and kept him awake for another 2 hours. "You won't leave me, will you? You won't leave me alone." Before that, she had been good in bed, so good he was stunned. Her touch was light and sensual and nearly playful. It had been that way until they found the monster shelter, and last night. There had been other things before then, things that troubled him. But something like this, so he had rationalized it, if it only makes you a little bit psycho, you're way ahead. 2 nights ago, he had awakened sometime after 2 and had heard her weeping softly in the bathroom. He knew she was taking sleeping pills and the big red and yellow gel capsules that were known as yellow jackets out on the coast. Big downers. He told himself she'd probably been taking them long before the superflu came along. She followed him, too, even standing in the bathroom door and talking to him while he was shaving or showering. He was a private bathroom person, but he told himself that some weren't. A lot of it depended on your upbringing. He would have a talk with her sometime. But now, was he going to have to carry her on his back? Christ, he hoped not. She had seemed stronger than that, at least at first. It was the reason she had appealed to him so strongly that day in the park. There's no more truth in advertising, he thought bitterly. How the hell was he qualified to take care of her when he could barely watch out for himself? He'd shown that pretty conclusively after the record had broken for him. "No, I'm not mad," he said. "It's just that, you know, I'm not your boss. If you don't feel like eating, just say so." "I told you. I said I didn't think I could—" "The fuck you did!" She bent her head and looked at her hands, and he knew she was struggling to keep from sobbing. For a moment he was angrier than ever, wanting to shout, "I'm not your father. I'm not your big-shot banker husband. I'm not going to take care of you. You got 30 years on me, for God's sake." Then he felt the familiar surge of self-contempt and wondered what the hell could be the matter with him. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'm an insensitive bastard." "No, it's just that all of this is starting to catch up with me. Yesterday, that poor man in the park, I thought, no one is ever going to catch whoever did that and put him in jail. Whoever did it will just go on and do it again and again and again, like an animal in the jungle. Don't you see?" "Yes," he said. "Yes, I can see that." He had lost his mother, and she had lost the man who brought her Mercedes around. But somehow her loss was supposed to be greater. Well, bullshit. It was the pills. They were bumming her out. "Try not to be angry with me. I'll do better." "You're fine," he said, and helped her to her feet. "Come on now, we've got a lot to do. What do you say? Feel up to it?" "Yes," she said, but her expression was the same as it had been when he offered her the eggs. "When we get out of the city, you'll feel better." She looked at him nakedly. "Will I?" "Sure. Sure you will." It was a walk that Larry Underwood never forgot. So much had changed, so much was out of joint, that New York now seemed almost a fabled city in a Tolkien story. A man had been hung from the street sign at 5th and 53rd, a placard with the single word "looter" hung around his neck. There was a cat lying on top of a hexagonal litter basket, which still bore advertisements for a chorus line. The cat was giving suck to a litter of kittens and enjoying the morning sun. They reached the corner of 5th and 39th shortly after noon, and Larry suggested lunch. There was a deli on the corner, but when he pushed the door open, the smell of rotten meat made Rita draw back. I better not go in there if I want to save what appetite I have, she said apologetically. Larry suspected he could have found plenty of good meat, stuffed loaded with preservatives, inside, but he didn't like leaving her alone on the sidewalk. So they found a bench half a block west and ate dehydrated apple slices, bacon bits, and cheese spread on Ritz crackers. Everything tastes better when it sits on a Ritz, Larry said, doing an Andy Griffith drawl, and Rita giggled. This time I was really hungry, she said, and offered him the thermos of coffee. I'll catch a Pepsi later on, he said. The thought of drinking coffee her way made him feel a little ill. Otherwise, he felt good. Just to be on the move, that felt good. He had told her she would feel better when they got out of New York. It had been something to say. Now, consulting the rising barometer of his own spirits, he guessed that it had also been true. Being in New York was like being in a graveyard where all the dead were not yet quiet. The sooner out, the better. North now, and south in September or October. Booth Bay Harbor in the summer, Key Biscayne in the winter. It had a nice ring. Occupied with his thoughts, he didn't see her grimace of pain as he stood up and shouldered the rifle he had insisted on bringing. They were moving west now, their shadows behind them, at first as squat as frogs, beginning to lengthen out as the afternoon progressed. They passed the Avenue of the Americas, 7th Avenue, 8th, 9th, 10th. The streets were crammed and silent, frozen rivers of automobiles in every color, predominated by the yellow of the taxicabs. Many of the cars had become hearses, their decaying drivers still leaning behind the wheels, their passengers slumped as if, weary of the traffic jam, they had fallen asleep. At the intersection of 39th and 7th, they saw a young man wearing cut-off denim shorts and nothing else lying atop a ding-dong taxi. "Is he dead?" Rita asked. And at the sound of her voice, the young man sat up, looked around, saw them, and waved. They waved back. The young man lay placidly back down. It was just after 2 o'clock when they crossed 11th Avenue. He heard a muffled cry of pain behind him and realized Rita was no longer walking on his left. She was down on one knee holding her foot. With something like horror, Larry noticed for the first time that she was wearing expensive open-toed sandals, probably in the $80 range, just the thing for a four-block stroll along Fifth Avenue while window shopping, but for a long walk, a hike really, like the one they had been making. The ankle straps had chafed through her skin. Blood was trickling down her ankles.
Larry,
He jerked her abruptly to her feet.
What were you thinking about? He shouted into her face.
He felt a moment's shame at the miserable way she recoiled, but also a mean sort of pleasure.
Did you think you could cab back to your apartment if your feet got tired?
I never thought...
Well, Christ!
He ran his hands through his hair.
I guess you didn't. You're bleeding, Rita. How long has it been hurting?
Her voice was so low and husky that he had trouble hearing her, even in the preternatural silence.
Since about 5th and 49th, I guess. Your feet have been hurting you for 20 fucking blocks and you didn't say anything?
I thought it might go away, not hurt anyone. I didn't want to. We were making such good time getting out of the city, I just thought...
You didn't think at all, he said angrily. How much good time are we going to make with you like this? Your fucking feet look like you got fucking crucified.
Don't swear at me, Larry, she said, beginning to sob. Please don't. It makes me feel so bad when you... Please don't swear at me.
He was in an ecstasy of rage now, and later he would not even be able to understand why the sight of her bleeding feet had blown all his circuits that way. For the moment, it didn't matter. He screamed into her face, Fuck! Fuck! Fuck!
The words echoed back from the high-rise apartment buildings, dim and meaningless. She put her hands over her face and leaned forward, crying. It made him even angrier, and he supposed that part of it was that she really didn't want to see. She would just as soon put her hands over her face and let him lead her. Why not? There'd always been someone around to take good care of little Rita. Someone to drive the car, do the marketing, wash out the toilet bowl, do the taxes. So let's put on some of that gagging Swede Debussy and put our well-manicured hands over our eyes and leave it all up to Larry. Take care of me, Larry, after seeing what happened to the monster shouter. I've decided I don't want to see any more. It's all rather sordid for one of my breeding and background. He yanked her hands away. She cringed and tried to put them over her eyes again. Look at me. She shook her head. God damn it, you look at me, Rita. She finally did, in a strange, flinching way, as if thinking he would now go to work on her with his fists as well as his tongue. I want to tell you the facts of life because you don't seem to understand them. The fact is, we may have to walk 20 or 30 miles. The fact is, if you get infected from those scrapes, you could get blood poisoning and die. The fact is, you've got to get your thumb out of your ass and start helping me. He had been holding her by the upper arms, and he saw that his thumbs had almost disappeared into her flesh. His anger broke when he saw the red marks that appeared there when he let her go. He stepped away, feeling uncertain again, knowing with sick certainty that he had overreacted. Larry Underwood strikes again. If he was so goddamn smart, why hadn't he checked out her footgear before they started out? Because that's her problem, part of him said with surly defensiveness. No, that wasn't true. It had been his problem. Because she didn't know. If he was going to take her with him, and it was only today that he had begun to think how much simpler life would be if he hadn't, he was just going to have to be responsible for her. Be damned if I will, the surly voice said. His mother. You're a taker, Larry. The oral hygienist from Fordham crying out her window after him. I thought you were a nice guy. You ain't no nice guy. There's something left out of you, Larry. You're a taker. That's a lie. This is a goddamn lie. Rita, he said, I'm sorry. She sat down on the pavement in her sleeveless blouse and her white deck pants, her hair looking gray and old. She bowed her head and held her hurt feet. She wouldn't look at him. I'm sorry, he repeated. Look, I had no right to say those things. He did, but never mind. If you apologized, things got smoothed over. It was how the world worked. Go on, get out of here, she said. Don't let me slow you down. I said I was sorry, he told her, his voice a trifle petulant. We'll get you some new shoes and some white socks. We'll nothing. Go on. Rita, I'm sorry. If you say that one more time, I'll scream. You're a shit and your apology is not accepted. Now go on. I said I was... She threw her head back and shrieked. He took a step backward, looking around to see if anyone had heard her, to see if maybe a policeman was running over to see what kind of awful thing that young fellow was doing to that old lady who was sitting on the sidewalk with her shoes off. Culture lag, he thought distractedly. What fun it all is. She stopped screaming and looked at him. She made a flicking gesture with her hand, as if he was a bothersome fly. You better stop, he said, or I really will leave you. She only looked at him. He couldn't meet her eyes, and so dropped his gaze, hating her for making him do that. All right, he said. Have a good time getting raped and murdered. He shouldered the rifle and started off again, now angling left toward the car-packed 495 entrance ramp, sloping down toward the tunnel's mouth. At the foot of the ramp, he saw there had been one hell of a crash. A man driving a Mayflower moving van had tried to butt his way into the main traffic flow, and cars were scattered around the van like bowling pins. A burned-out Pinto lay almost beneath the van's body. The van's driver hung halfway out of the cab window, head down, arms dangling. Larry looked around, sure he would see her either walking toward him or standing and accusing him with her eyes. But Rita was gone. Fuck you, he said with nervous resentment. I tried to apologize. For a moment he couldn't go on. He felt impaled by hundreds of angry dead eyes staring out at him from all these cars. A line of Dylan occurred to him. I waited for you inside of the frozen traffic when you knew I had some other place to be. But where are you tonight, sweet Marie? Ahead, he could see four lanes of westbound traffic disappearing into the black arch of the tunnel. And with something like real dread, he saw that the overhead fluorescent bars inside the Lincoln were out. It would be like going into an automobile graveyard. They would let him get halfway, and then they would all begin to stir, to come alive. He would hear car doors clicking open, and then softly chunking closed, their shuffling footsteps. A light sweat broke on his body. Overhead, a bird called raucously, and he jumped. You're being stupid, he told himself. Kid stuff, that's what this is. All you have to do is stay on the pedestrian catwalk, and in no time at all, you'll be... strangled by the walking dead. He licked his lips and tried to laugh. It came out badly. He walked 5 paces toward the place where the ramp joined the highway, and then stopped again. To his left was a caddy, an Eldorado, and a woman with a blackened troll face was staring out at him. Her nose was pressed into a bulb against the glass. Both blood and snot had trickled out onto the window. The man who had been driving the caddy was slumped over the wheel, as if looking for something on the floor. All the caddy's windows were rolled up. It would be like a greenhouse in there. If he opened the door, the woman would spill out and break open on the pavement like a sack of rotten melons, and the smell would be warm and steamy, wet and crawling with decay. The way it would smell in the tunnel. Abruptly, Larry turned around and trotted back the way he had come, feeling the breeze he was making cool the sweat on his forehead. Rita? Rita, listen, I want to... The words died as he reached the top of the ramp. Rita was still gone. 39th Street dwindled away to a point. He ran from the south sidewalk to the north, squeezing between bumpers and scrambling over hoods almost hot enough to blister his skin. But the north sidewalk was also empty. He cupped his hands around his mouth and cried, "Rita! Rita!" His only answer, a dead echo. "Rita! Ida! Ida! Ida!" By 4 o'clock, dark clouds had begun to build over Manhattan, and the sound of thunder rolled back and forth between the city's cliffs. Lightning forked down across the city. The light had become yellow and strange, and Larry didn't like it. His belly was cramped, and when he lit a cigarette, it trembled in his hand the way the coffee cup had trembled in Rita's this morning. He was sitting at the street end of the access ramp, leaning his back against the lowest bar of the railing. His pack was on his lap, and the 30-30 was leaning against the railing beside him. He had thought she would get scared and come back, but she hadn't. 15 minutes ago, he had given up calling her name. The echoes freaked him out. Thunder rolled again, close this time. A chilly breeze ran its hand over the back of his shirt, which was pasted to his skin with sweat. He was going to have to get inside somewhere, or else stop shitting around and go through that tunnel. If he couldn't work up the guts to go through, he'd have to spend another night in the city and go over the George Washington Bridge in the morning, and that was 140 blocks north.